long ago, far away, life was clear, close your eyes.
Now KSFO presents Those Unforgettable Years.
Remember is a place from long ago. Remember, remember.
Hello there, I'm Norman Davis, and once again I'd like to invite you along on another trip back to a year I think most of us will never forget. Tonight our destination is the year that brought to a climax the chaotic 60s. It was an amazing year, a year when the unexpected became normal, a year of great achievements and horrible atrocities, a year of big mouths and big sticks, too. Here's a little taste of what's ahead as we go back to that unforgettable year, 1969.
We cannot learn from one another until we stop shouting at one another.
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
He seemed like a nice guy, you know, trustworthy and everything. He didn't seem in any way strange. It's just really hard to believe. It's really shocking that they think he's connected with this.
I, Richard Billhouse Nixon, do solemnly swear that I,
General of the Army, Dwight David Eisenhower,
I was overcome, I'm frank to say, by a jumble of emotions, grief, fear, doubt.
Because we're all in this same puzzle, and we can work it out. We can make it groovy.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
We know that the best noisemakers are not necessarily the best peacemakers.
An effete core of impudent snobs who characterize
being shot by members of my company.
Fans are climbing all over them. They're jumping, leaping.
Police sirens in the background. Occasionally a firecracker going off.
Huge streamers. 8, 10, 12 stories long.
I've never seen it in my life. This is the first time I've ever seen it.
On January 20, 1969, Richard Milhouse Nixon, the two-time loser who had angrily given his last press conference some 6 years before and then miraculously climbed back to win the biggest political plum of all, was sworn in as the 37th President of the United States. Sometimes now when I think back, I wonder if he wishes he hadn't won that election sometimes. President Nixon faced a divided nation in 1969. The main reason for the split was the Vietnam War and the growing opposition to the war. But there were other reasons, too, and many of them. The music, the changing attitudes towards drugs and morals, some traditional American values were being challenged, and the result was about the same as when hot and cold weather systems come together. Big, bad storms. There was a lot of what they called bubblegum rock back in 1969. It seemed rather incongruous with everything else that was going on that year, but there it was nonetheless. In fact, the Archies record, Sugar Sugar, ended up the number one record of the year. Amazing, really. Another silly song became a hit in 1969, maybe more than another one, but at least one more. Shel Silverstein wrote a song about a boy with an improbable name. Johnny Cash recorded it, and we hear Johnny doing his hit song now in a live performance before a selected audience at San Quentin. He recorded an album of songs there in 1969, which also became a bestseller.
Well, my daddy left home when I was 3, and he didn't leave much to Ma and me. Bill or George, anything but Sue. I feel like this.
All right, thank you very much.
Johnny Cash, live at San Quentin in 1969.
From America to Vietnam, I'm fighting the battle to be won. I'm fighting for my country and Uncle Sam. From America to Vietnam, from America to Vietnam.
Most Americans wished the war would go away in 1969, but it would not, and the resulting anguish and anger caused an even deeper split in the fabric of American society. In Vietnam, our boys were getting stoned on Asian grass, refusing orders on occasion, and still fighting battles like Hamburger Hill.
Dearest Mom, I'm now on the hill, Hamburger Hill. We had some hot chow yesterday for the first time in a long time. We haven't had any trouble with the gooks lately. Since the 187 lost half of the battalion, I will give you an example. If you promise not to worry about me. Company A of the 187th, his lieutenant told me he had 8 men left that still walk around. Well, Mom, I'm closing now. I have to say goodbye. Your son, Nicholas Perry.
Back at home, the protests were getting bigger and louder. There were student strikes and campus shutdowns, and finally, enough people were fed up enough to organize a giant nationwide protest. On October 15th, millions of Americans demonstrated for peace in towns and cities across the country. President Nixon was asked if this massive outpouring would influence his course.
Under no circumstances will I be affected, whatever, by it.
Nixon watched football on television while demonstrators paraded around the White House. And then Vice President Agnew joined the battle, and suddenly his name was a household word.
A spirit of national masochism prevails, encouraged by an effete core of impudent snobs who characterize themselves as intellectuals. And this country can't afford to be torn to pieces by that kind of demonstrating in the streets.
I'm free to march in the streets. You don't want me to have this free. The morale of the American fighting men in Vietnam has dropped because of people like you. This march was got the blessings of the premier of North Vietnam and the people like you that support the Vietnam. Anybody supports this is a communist. Out and out.
Small cadres of professional protesters are allowed to jeopardize the peace efforts of the President of the United States. It's time to question the credentials of their leaders. And if in questioning we disturb a few people, I say it's time for them to be disturbed. And if in challenging we polarize the American people, I say it's time for a positive polarization. There are some leaders today who, instead of lowering their voices, are raising strident calls to the flag, to patriotism, and against communism. They are even using the age-old device of imputing disloyalty to those in dissent. We say to them, you will not put us off with the divisive, clamorous, pointless rhetoric of yesteryears. We know that the best noisemakers are not necessarily the best peacemakers.
President Nixon had promised that he had a secret plan to end the Vietnam War in his 1968 campaign, but he did not reveal it until November of 1969.
We have adopted a plan which we have worked out in cooperation with the South Vietnamese for the complete withdrawal of all U.S. combat ground forces and their replacement by South Vietnamese forces on an orderly scheduled timetable. And so tonight, to you, the great silent majority of my fellow Americans, I ask for your support. I pledged in my campaign for the presidency to end the war in a way that we could win the peace. Let us be united for peace. Let us also be united against defeat. Because let us understand, North Vietnam cannot defeat or humiliate the United States. Only Americans can do that.
And as Nixon talked peace, a story of a massacre leaked out, the story of My Lai, where American soldiers were reported to have murdered innocent civilians. Captain Ernest Medina denied any knowledge of a massacre.
I did not receive any reports from any of the people that there was a massacre at My Lai 4, or that any of them had committed any atrocity at My Lai 4. I did not give any orders to massacre or shoot any women and children.
But a soldier who was there told a very different story.
It was just like any ordinary Vietnamese village. Usually the ones that we go to are women, children, old men. And what was happening is the people were being shot by the members of my company, being rounded up into groups. I saw, at least myself, I saw a group rounded up and fired into. And all the civilians, to my knowledge, there were killed.
The conclusion to the My Lai massacre story would come in 1970, and as 1969 ended, we were still a country at war. Friends of Distinction and their hit Grazin' in the Grass, and before that, Tommy James and the Shondells' big 1969 hit, Crystal Blue Persuasion. Both of those songs were thought to be drug-related in some way. Drugs were very much on our minds in 1969, and not just the illegal ones. There was a lot of talk about, some that had been legal and were being made illegal, including one specifically called DDT. There was a lot of talk about that in 1969. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration stopped cattlemen from injecting their livestock with most antibiotics. The Ernest Lee Huckleby family of Alamogordo, Texas, just north of El Paso, ate some pork from hogs fed with millet seeds treated with a mercury fungicide. Some of the Huckleby children went blind from eating that pork and suffered brain damage from mercury poisoning. Coho salmon from Michigan lakes and streams were tested and found to have DDT concentrations of 20 parts per million. That was 20 times the allowable, and the FDA seized 14 tons of fish. Arizona and Michigan restricted use of DDT. Sierra Club President David Brower testified before a House committee that mother's milk contained four times the amount of DDT permitted in cow's milk. Some wit suggested, he said, that if mother's milk were packaged in different containers, we wouldn't allow it across state lines. The use of monosodium glutamate in baby foods was halted by three major manufacturers after tests showed MSG in large amounts caused brain damage in laboratory animals. The U.S. food industry used 20 million pounds of cyclamates in 1969, mostly in soft drinks. And then in October, cyclamates were removed from the FDA's list of safe sweeteners, and products were recalled after laboratory rats developed cancer when fed large amounts of the stuff. Some doubts were raised, however, as to the validity of those tests. All from 1969, that unforgettable year, will continue in just a moment. The Young Bloods, their number 13 hit for all of 1969, called Get Together. The Young Bloods were scheduled to appear on the Johnny Carson Tonight Show on NBC. And apparently, according to Johnny anyway, they complained so much about the lights and the stage and everything else that he said later, we just wiped their noses and told them they'd only been in showbiz a week and a half anyway, and sent them home. Stevie Wonder, 1969 style, My Cherie Amour was his biggest hit of the year. We talked about drugs a while ago, some legal ones, and of course the use of illegal ones, especially marijuana, was growing in 1969. Among young people, its use was becoming quite common. That was especially noticeable at a new phenomenon called rock festivals. Festivals kind of peaked in 1969, really. There was hardly a weekend when there wasn't some kind of big outdoor rock music show. From Miami to Venice, California, from Texas to Canada, people gathered by the hundreds of thousands to get high and enjoy the music. The big one was, of course, the festival we remember as Woodstock, an amazing event in upstate New York that was memorialized with a movie and two albums, and several books as well, and probably will not be forgotten for a very long time. The promoters of the Woodstock Music and Art Fair expected about 120,000 people to show up, but when over 400,000 did, totally stopping traffic on highways and creating enormous problems for local citizens and the festival organizers, it became a very different plan. The talent was a compendium of the best rock could offer in 1969, and although some of the older generation looked on with suspicion and even revulsion, it turned out to be a very positive experience for nearly everyone involved. The music was about freedom and dope and love.
I'm a farmer. I don't know how to speak to 20 people in one mind, let alone a crowd like this. This is the largest group of people ever assembled in one place. But I think you people have proven something to the world, that a half a million kids can get together and have 3 days of fun and music, and have nothing but fun and music. And I got a bunch of fun.
Marijuana. Exhibit A.
Yeah, it's far out, man. I don't know if you... how many of you can dig how many people there are, man. Like I was rapping to the fuzz. Right? Can you dig it? Man, there's supposed to be a million and a half people here by tonight. Can you dig that? New York State Thruway is closed, man.
The freeways were closed for a time, and most other highways and roads in the area. And there were many other problems, lack of sanitary facilities, food shortages, and terrible weather. Torrential rains turned the festival site into mud, but the show went right on to everyone's delight.
Good morning. What we have in mind is breakfast in bed for 400,000.
And that was Woodstock. A little bit of it there. Quite a show. Like nothing anybody had ever seen or heard before. Raised a lot of questions in people's minds who thought all those dope smokers were all criminals. The vibrations from Woodstock would affect us for a long time to come. The Beatles. A study in contrasts, as many things were in 1969. There was one more Beatle item of note that year. An Illinois University newspaper ran an article under the headline Clues Hint at Beatle Death in September. It was the beginning of one of the biggest hypes of the decade. Citing the album cover for the Sgt. Pepper album, which featured a hand over Paul McCartney's head, and a spoken line at the end of the song Strawberry Fields Forever, which supposedly says Paul is dead, rumors started flying that Paul McCartney had died in a car crash, and the fact was being kept secret from the public. When the album Abbey Road was released a few days later, rumor mongers noted that Paul was barefoot and dressed all in black, very different from the other three Beatles. More fuel for the hoax. In October, a mysterious phone call to a Detroit radio station told them to listen to the Beatles' recording of Revolution No. 9 backwards. And supposedly, if you did, you could hear a voice saying, "Turn me on, dead man." In November, the New York Times even reported that the Paul is dead rumor was sweeping the world. Paul McCartney eventually informed journalists and the world from his Scotland farm that rumors of his demise were premature, but those rumors continued to spread for quite a time. And that's Joe South with a song called Games People Play, another big hit from 1969. In fact, when they handed out the Grammys, that was the song of the year. I'm Norman Davis, and we're looking back right now at that unforgettable year, 1969, a truly unforgettable year, probably the most intense with the most activity of any year that I've researched so far in our series, which so far have covered the 50s and 60s. Well, there were a couple of interesting couples in the headlines, two of our favorite couples, in fact. In 1969, Richard Burton bought Elizabeth Taylor the largest diamond in the world as a little gift, and we learned that Aristotle Onassis and Jackie Kennedy Onassis were spending $400,000 a week on living expenses. Now, if you think that's impossible to spend $400,000 a week, remember that they had 200 full-time servants, kept up 9 houses around the world, and they also had a huge yacht equipped with its own airplane. Living expenses, yes, they had lots of them. Creedence Clearwater Revival, one of our favorite bands around San Francisco in 1969. They had several hits that year. That was Down on the Corner. And another group from the Bay Area that was also very hot in 1969 had two in the top five, including the one we heard by Sly and the Family Stone called Hot Fun in the Summertime. There's one of the songs from Hair that was a big hit. I think there were three on the charts in 1969. That was the Cowsills, and it is just a little past one here at 560 KSFO in San Francisco. Norman Davis, and you looking back at that unforgettable year, 1969. From the Grammy Award-winning Album of the Year in 1969, Blood, Sweat, and Tears again, and You've Made Me So Very Happy. Well, the big event of 1969, an event that made a lot of folks happy in a year of big events, happened in July. At 9:32 in the morning on July 16th, three astronauts, Neil Armstrong, Michael Collins, and Edwin Buzz Aldrin, lifted off from Launch Complex 39, in Apollo 11. The spacecraft traveled at nearly 25,000 miles an hour to the moon, sending television pictures back to Earth in color to more than 500 million viewers. On July 19, after traveling 244,000 miles in a little over 3 days, the command craft went into orbit around the moon. Collins stayed on board while Aldrin and Armstrong took the lunar module Eagle down to the moon's surface. It was a very exciting moment in Earth's history.
75 feet. Guys looking good. Down a half. Descent. Host control, both auto. Descent engine command override off. Engine arm on.
We're home.
413 is in.
Man on the moon.
We copy you down, Eagle.
Griffin,
Oh, jeez.
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed. Stay busy for a minute.
Wally, say something. I'm speechless.
I'm just trying to hold on to my breath.
That was Wally Schirra, by the way, with Walter Cronkite. I'll never forget how excited and happy Walter Cronkite was as the lunar module landed on the moon. Probably more excited than I've ever seen him on television. And so the goal of the past decade was finally realized with that touchdown. Armstrong appeared to be calm as he announced the landing on the moon, but instruments showed his heart was beating at twice its normal rate. The two astronauts were supposed to rest for 8 hours before exploring the moon, but they were too excited to do that. So after putting on their life support systems and depressurizing the cabin, they opened the hatch and Armstrong stepped out and down the ladder. At 10:56 p.m., he reached the bottom.
I'm at the foot of the ladder. The lamb footbeds are only depressed in the surface about 1 or 2 inches. Although the surface appears to be very, very fine-grained as you get close to it. It's almost like a powder. Ground mass is very fine. I'm going to step off the limb now. That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
And so the race to the moon was over, and it was an American who read the words on a plaque placed at the landing site.
Dear men from the planet Earth, first set foot upon the moon, July 1969, with peace. We came in peace for all mankind. It has the crew members' signatures and the signature of the President of the United States.
Hello, Neil and Buzz. I'm talking to you by telephone from the Oval Room at the White House. And this certainly has to be the most historic telephone call ever made. I just can't tell you how proud we all are of what you... For every American, this has to be the proudest day of our lives. For one priceless moment in the whole history of man, all the people on this earth are truly one.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Mr. President Nixon was extremely excited and happy over the moon landing. In fact, he called it the greatest achievement since creation. And after 2.5 historic hours of checking their ship, collecting samples, and performing various tests, the two astronauts climbed back into their ship for the historic ride home. Behind, they left some junk, some cameras and backpacks and tools, and some footprints that will probably, in that airless place, last forever. It was a triumph of technology and the fulfillment of a dream as old as mankind. Mary, another big hit for Creedence Clearwater Revival, who probably had their biggest year ever in 1969, and put three of them in the top 50 that year. From 560 KSFO, this is Norman Davis looking back with you at that unforgettable year, 1969.
KSFO. People
never do they say why their world is so mixed up or how it got that way.
The voice you're listening to belongs to Charles Manson. Charles Manson came into our consciousness in a big way late in 1969. Novelist Jerzy Kosinski was flying to Los Angeles to join his friend Wojtek Frykowski at a party being given at the Hollywood home of actress Sharon Tate on the evening of August 8th. During the evening, some uninvited guests attended that party, incited by their cult leader, who was indeed Charles Manson. His followers Charles, Tex Watson, Susan Atkins, Patricia Krenwinkel, and Leslie Van Houten shot and stabbed to death. Sharon Tate, who was pregnant, Jay Sebring, Folger's coffee heiress Abigail Folger, Stephen Parent, and Frykowski. The expected guest, Jerry Kosinski, was delayed because his luggage had been mistakenly sent to New York instead of Los Angeles. Kosinski barely missed the party. He later wrote about his close call in a novel entitled Blind Date. Later that same day, supermarket president Lino Bianco and his wife Rosemary were murdered also in Los Angeles. Police at first said there was no connection between the two crimes, but a jury would find Charles Manson and his unholy family guilty of all seven murders in 1970. And that's a story we'll cover next week in the next edition of Those Unforgettable Years.
Driving the train through clear, the rock and sky.